Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Friday, August 25th, 2023. Some Sudanese church leaders and Islamic leaders accused the rival forces fighting in some parts of Sudan of destroying places of worship.
The army entered the premises of the church and broke into the offices, and they are now using it as their operations base, including my office.
And a South Sudanese journalist participating in this year's Yale Fellowship says the media environment in South Sudan is dangerous.
The work of the media is not necessarily understood by everyone, so it's still challenging for journalists to go out and report. It's still challenging to film around the city. It's still very challenging to interview or to carry out the work, as much as people are in need of the media.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some Muslim and Christian leaders in Sudan are accusing the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces of attacking and using places of worship as launching pad for military operations. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
The former Sudanese Minister for Religious Affairs and Endowment, Nasruddin Muferra, says perpetrators of current attacks on places of worship in Sudan could be held accountable for their actions. A group of Muslim and Christian religious leaders have also expressed their concerns over the continued attacks on mosques and churches during the ongoing fighting in the country. The religious leaders say the rival forces in Sudan's conflict have allegedly destroyed 15 places of worship and occupied five others in Khartoum, Omdurman, and Khartoum North. The head of the Sudanese Baptist Church, Reverend Philmon Hassan, told VOA this week from the Ugandan capital, Kampala, that the Presbyterian Church in Bahri was bombed and adjacent offices and library were burned to ashes in May. Hassan says the Sudan Armed Forces have turned the compound of the Baptist Church in Khartoum North into a military theater.
The army entered the premises of the church and broke into the offices, and they are now using it as their operations base, including my office. Up to this moment, they are still stationed there.
Sudanese military spokesperson Brigadier General Nabil Abdullah denies the army attacked or occupied any place of worship in Khartoum or elsewhere. He says the army's high command adheres to international humanitarian law during combat operations.
Sudan armed forces include both Muslims and Christians, and therefore it respects all the religions equally in Sudan. This accusation is not true, and I can assure you that it is baseless.
Nasruddin Muferra leads a group calling itself Religious Leaders for Peace and Social Cohesion, an initiative advocating for an end to the conflict in Sudan. He says more than 10 religious personnel have been killed and 15 others injured during the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
They include imams of mosques, students of khalwa, and servants of the church. Some churches were subjected to looting, and some mosques and churches were destroyed completely.
VOA conducted the RSF's military spokesperson, Faris Noor, several times for comment on this story, but he did not respond. Eyewitnesses in Khartoum also say the rapid support forces allegedly entered the All Saints Cathedral of the Episcopal Church in Amarat and destroyed offices and looted valuable items, including cars. More than 4.5 million people have been displaced inside and outside Sudan due to the conflict that erupted on April 15th between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, according to the United Nations. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Still on Sudanese conflict, UN agencies warn the conflict in Sudan is fueling a humanitarian emergency of epic proportion, which risks tipping the entire region into a humanitarian catastrophe. The UN reports the conflict is spreading throughout the country, spreading hunger and disease in its wake. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In a statement issued Friday, Griffith said the conflict, which has ravaged the capital Khartoum and Darfur since April 15, is spreading to Kordofan and is moving toward Al Jazeera State, the breadbasket of Sudan. Jens Laerke is deputy spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. He says Griffith's fears hunger, disease, and displacement could consume the entire country if Sudan's rival warlords continue to put their quest for power above the needs of the Sudanese people.
The longer this fighting continues, the more devastating its impact is going to be. Hundreds of thousands of children are already severely malnourished and at imminent risk of death if left untreated. Millions more will have their education replaced by the devastating traumas of war, becoming a lost generation.
Since violence erupted between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces in mid-April, the UN Refugee Agency reports more than 3.6 million people have been displaced inside Sudan and nearly 1 million have fled across borders as refugees. The World Health Organization reports 67% of all main hospitals are out of service, and hospitals that remain fully or partially functional risk closing for lack of medical staff, supplies, water, and electricity. WHO spokesperson Tarek Jazarevich says some critical services, including maternal and child health care and treatment of patients with chronic non-communicable diseases, have been discontinued in many areas.
There are reports on communicable diseases and outbreaks, and that will probably worsen with the rainy season. So there are reports of dengue, measles, acute watery diarrhea, but also of severe acute malnutrition. When there is a deterioration of a health system that affects everything.
OCHA reports millions of civilians need life-saving assistance now, but humanitarians are not able to access people in need because of the insecure environment in which they work. Another problem, it says, is lack of funding. It notes only 26% of the UN's $2.57 billion appeal has been received. UN officials are urging international donors to respond generously to Sudan's outsized humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on the crisis in Sudan, authorities in the contested Abyei area say thousands of returnees who fled the conflict in Sudan are in need of humanitarian assistance. The commissioner of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Abyei says the returnees lack shelter, food, and medical supplies. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Ajak Deng Mien, the head of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, or RRC, in Abyei, says thousands of returnees and refugees who are entering the area face numerous humanitarian challenges. Mien says the returnees need shelter, food, and medicines.
So now, it's above 10,000, is about 12,000 individuals that have arrived in Abyei. And the refugees is around 1,000. 200, and they are always transported to the refugee camp that was created in the northern part of Azal. The Syrian situation is, as you know, is difficult a bit, although there is a response. They are facing a lot of problems.
Mien added that majority of the returnees have joined their relatives in Abyei town, while others are camping in the open. He says Sudanese who entered the country through Abyei traveled to a refugee camp in northern Bahr el Ghazali state. Agwek Ngor fled the conflict in Sudan a few months ago and is now living in Abyei town. He says he and his family have no food and other basic services.
Living is very poor. Food to eat is the major problem. It is not there. Plus, other basic services like clean water, medicine, and shelters. Now, majority of returnees are living in open and others are sheltering with their relatives. We need help. I call upon the government and the NGOs to help us.
Another returnee, Joel Agwok, says his family depends on the small food rations provided by the UN World Food Programme.
Situation is very, very bad. A lot of people came from there. They are still having a problem also of living, especially food is very, very, very difficult for the people here. Yeah, things are very expensive. No money to buy, and no somebody distributing food like UN, like well food. They are not helping people.
Peter Bander Awarat, acting UN humanitarian coordinator for South Sudan, released a statement last week stressing on the impact of the conflict in Sudan, which has triggered an influx of over 220,000 refugees, returnees, and third country nationals into South Sudan since April. The UN said the overcrowding at border point, transit centers, and the protection of civilian sites in Upper Nile State could increase tensions and conflict over access to basic services and resources. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a South Sudanese journalist shares her experience on the difficult working environment in the country. Find out more after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was booked at the Fulton County, Georgia jail Thursday on 41 charges that he and 18 co-defendants participated in schemes to meddle in the state's 2022 presidential election results. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The first ever arrest photograph of a former U.S. president. Taken as Donald Trump was processed on charges alleging he participated in a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in the key swing state of Georgia. Trump told reporters later Thursday that his opponents were trying to derail his presidential nomination bid.
What they're doing is election interference. They're trying to interfere with an election. There's never been anything like it in our country before.
Trump, who is the current frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, is not under arrest and can still campaign.
Now, this could get quite messy, as you can quite imagine, especially because the trials are the schedule of the trials is the same as the schedule of the election.
Trump faces 91 criminal charges across four separate cases, including allegations of campaign fraud in New York, mishandling of classified documents in Florida, and charges in a Washington court that he encouraged the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. But some analysts say Georgia's charges carry the most weight.
This is the most serious one for him politically. And the reason I say that is because they have him on tape talking about how he wanted to change the outcome of the election.
At a prayer rally in Georgia this week, members of faith communities pushed back against calls to remove District Attorney Fannie Willis from her position because she is prosecuting Trump.
District Attorney Willis has demonstrated courage, integrity, and unyielding commitment to upholding the principles of justice that lie at the heart of our legal system. Her efforts to investigate and prosecute former President Donald Trump sent a powerful message that accountability knows no bounds.
Outside the courthouse Thursday, dozens of the former president's supporters criticized the charges.
Our government, literally right before everyone's face, weaponized the justice system. This is crazy.
The president's former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who is among the 18 co-defendants accused of a criminal conspiracy, said the charges were unjust.
This case is a fight for our way of life. This indictment is a travesty.
But analysts say the large number of co-defendants could be a key factor in proving the case against Trump.
When you bring in multiple defendants on a criminal case, many of them may decide that they want to make a deal with one of the prosecutors to lessen their own penalty that they would receive in the case. And by doing so, they would have to agree with the prosecutor to provide evidence that the prosecutor doesn't already have.
Willis has asked the court to begin the trial for Trump and his co-defendants on October 23rd of this year. Trump opposed the trial date in a filing Thursday afternoon. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Voice of America hosted Thursday 18 young African leaders participating in the Mandela Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders. The flagship program, also known as YALI, brings accomplished leaders from Africa with a record of promoting innovation and positive impact on their communities. Asafi Kampako is a young South African leader who participated in the YALI program and says her exposures in the United States will help her bring change to her community in South Africa.
I work at the intersection of research and policy, and I'm interested in international policy making and in decisions that are made in this country about Africa and how we can elevate the voices of Africans on the international stage. And so I came here with the intention to build bridges.
She says Africa has been at the receiving end for a long time, adding that the narrative about the continent is changing.
I was struck by the level of conversation that is going on now about the continent and how America is repositioning itself and seeing Africa differently. I mean, the idea of Africa being seen as an equal partner came out very strongly in the U.S., the new U.S. strategy towards sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that that is a positive conversation and it should be encouraged.
A renowned Gambian civil society activist who has been in the forefront in the struggle for constitutional amendments in Gambia was among the fellows who visited VOA. Cherino Baye says young leaders in Africa should work together to address the challenges facing the continent.
I've learned a lot. One of the biggest lessons I learned is Africa is not the only continent with problems. That is one. Two, I have learned that nobody's going to come from outside to solve anything for us. This trip has opened my eyes for that. I always knew that to be a fact, but coming here made me realize this to be true. And thirdly, I realized that, like you were just saying in the beginning, that the problems in Africa are not unique to any single country. They are unique. You find them across the board in the entire African continent. So maybe if you want to fix this for me, then the young people need to come together more. There need to be more collaboration than competition and criticism.
Another YALI fellow, Rethelo Samethi from the Mountain Kingdom of Lesotho, says her 6-week studies in the United States has taught her one important virtue in life.
For me personally, I believe service leadership is about volunteering my skills, not for my own good, but for the betterment of others. Being a leader that understands the people and lives for the people and for the better good of the people, putting them first, understanding their needs and responding to those needs.
She adds that the experience gained from participating in the YALI Fellowship could change lives in Africa. She urges aspiring candidates to keep applying for the competitive Washington Mandela Fellowship.
We need to believe in ourselves, believe that we are making an impact, and be able to demonstrate that impact that we are making. When you go through your YALI application, the most important thing is for you to show us the impact that you are doing in the communities. Do not shy away from giving the examples of the amazing things that you have done, the amazing people that you have reached. Put in those numbers, and it doesn't matter how many times you have been applying, but one day you will get it. So people shouldn't be discouraged that they had applied but didn't make it. Some people make it after trying for 3 times.
Adeng Maik, a lecturer at the School of Journalism at the University of Juba and the founder of Media Development Foundation, was among the fellows. She spent 6 weeks at the University of Georgia focusing on leadership and civic engagement. She says the experience she has gained in the United States and the work she's doing in South Sudan are close to her heart.
We have the media laws in place. We have more people practicing journalism, but still it's a very difficult environment. The work of the media is not necessarily understood by everyone, so it's still challenging for journalists to go out and report. It's still challenging to film around the city. It's still very challenging to interview or to carry out the work, as much as people are in need of the media, but still... It's still difficult to understand. It's still a very difficult job to do.
And how do you navigate that environment and continue informing the people of South Sudan on, you know, information that is life-saving to them?
My effort in this area is through helping people that are practicing media in South Sudan. We do have a number of journalists that are joining the media sector, but they're not necessarily people who have been trained to be journalists. So this is where the work of my organization comes in. We aim at training early career journalists and people who are in the media industry that are not necessarily well trained to ethically carry out their job and to also help people consume information in a positive manner, and to also kind of like report accurately to the people. And I do teach at the university, so this is part of the effort to produce a generation that understand the importance of media, that understand the importance of factual information and ethical reporting.
And talk to us a little bit about the training, because a lot of media houses, including the Voice of America, are trying their best to, you know, identify journalists who could tell the South Sudan story from the South Sudan perspective. How difficult or how easy is it to get a journalist in South Sudan, a trained journalist, if you like?
There are more people practicing journalism now. It's not enough, of course, to cover everything that is happening in South Sudan, but it's the quality of journalism that is a problem. It's not who is doing the job or how many people are doing the job. We still don't have true stories about South Sudan on the internet, and this is one of the major challenges. So we do have local media houses that are covering the news for the people, but it's
why don't you have true stories about South Sudan on the internet? We post stories on our website and we talk to South Sudanese to tell their story. Why would you say there are no true stories about South Sudan on the internet?
There are a lot of stories with a very negative perspective about South Sudan. And if you look up any stories about South Sudan, the top things that will come up on the search is either the conflict or refugee crisis or either humanitarian crisis. These are the things that are usually on the news focus. So if there is no conflict happening, if there is no economic crisis, you hardly see South Sudan on the top search on the internet. And people around the world consume news through the internet right now, not necessarily traditional media. And in South Sudan, people really rely on traditional media. The main source of information could be local radio stations, community radio stations, and a few newspapers that are still trying to survive, to operate. But there is hardly anything from South Sudan on the internet that is positive. So the news that are usually negative are not exactly everything about South Sudan. There is more to cover about South Sudan. And South Sudanese themselves don't see anything about the country on the internet. And it's even affecting the education sector, basically. Let's say, working on a research about South Sudan, you can hardly find anything on the internet that is about the country. So saying that there is barely nothing on the internet is not that there are no reports, there are no stories. There are a few stories, but this is not everything about South Sudan. There's nothing about the people, the population, the culture, the history about the country. There is very little about that. So this is where I think we need to do more in terms of mainly covering stories about South Sudan with a different perspective, a different lens. Building.
That's Adeng Maik, a lecturer at the University of Juba School of Journalism and the founder of Media Development Foundation. She spoke to me on Thursday here at VOA's headquarters in Washington. We'll love to hear your remarks on issues in this broadcast. My colleague Nabil Biagio is ready with this week's listener comments. Take it over, Nabil.
Many of you wrote to us this week about news and events we cover on this program. We begin with this voice note.
This is Peter Goch Anyang Majongrul in Jonglei State, South Sudan. As Zimbabweans are on the election today, I urge them to do free and fair election to show political maturity to the world. Because in every race, there is a loser and a winner.
This South Sudan in Focus fan says, hello, good evening, VOA. Please call me John Khamis Inye. Bravo to the U.S. government for giving an alarm to its citizens operating businesses in South Sudan. Here in South Sudan, corruption is very high. The money used by the government can't reach the grassroots. Not even a single borehole has been drilled for the citizens. Are the citizens happy to vote in the 2024 general election? Another friend says, hello, VOA, my name is Peter Garkwath-Yuwal at the University of Juba. I would like to comment on the ongoing conflict in Sudan. My dear Sudanese leaders, especially the two generals who are fighting for power in the country, the nation should always be the priority over positions. Positions have been held by other people before, and it's better to give up for your citizens and sign a lasting peace. Thanks. May God bless John Tanza and Nabil Biagio for taking the time to read this to the public. Thongchuni Yongkwai from Juba, South Sudan says, to me, the issue of the budget passed by the SPLM-IG and some parties in Juba without SPLM-SPLA-IO is not a good move. We need parties that sign the 2018 peace agreement to work together and implement the remaining chapters in the peace agreement without problems. Thomas Kuntod in Old Fangak Payam in Fangak County in Jonglei State writes, Fangak County has been hit again by another epidemic of hepatitis E and measles as well. Additionally, the malnutrition rate is much higher than in the last 2 years. Around 50 malnutrition patients are usually admitted per month at the MSF France Hospital in Old Fangak Payam. This listener says, this is a Spiro from DRC Congo. Why do you collect weapons only from Central Equatoria, leaving Lake State and Warap State where cattle keepers have many weapons? That's not good. The government should be serious about collecting weapons. It should be done all over the nation. This listener says, hello, VOA. It's me, Raymond Morish Wani, in Tika Rhino Camp. I want to send my regards to all the people of South Sudan. May God bless and protect them, excluding the political leaders who have made us suffer in a foreign country like for now. The views expressed here do not reflect the views of VOA or of this program. We appreciate hearing from all of you. Keep those comments coming.
And that's all we prepared for you this Friday, August 25th, 2023. We now leave you with JJ D. Muzika and the song, Ya Mary.
JJ D. Muzika International. Panasalia Musala. Antikina Yemunda Kuyemari Lotina Dawara Loma. Ramadan Lular Abui Mulusi Dome.
We have been listening to a taste of that music from JJ D. Muzika. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Justin Twas, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.